There is a graphic description in the book of Revelation of some church people who are so distasteful that God spews them out of his mouth. Spews is an antique word. In modern speech, God gags at the taste of such people who are described as lukewarm. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I watch with some interest the people who are, and I notice that they're forever having the cup refilled. "Warm up my coffee," they ask the waiter. They can't stand it lukewarm. Well, the author of this last book in the New Testament believes that God feels that way about people. Some people wants all people to have passion and excitement, cannot bear that they should be lukewarm. Lukewarm people are bored people. And the hint in Revelation is that they are bored because they already have everything they want. One of the causes of boredom would seem to be total self-sufficiency, which may be why I can't remember much boredom among the kids I played with. We lacked so many things that we spent countless creative hours making up our own toys and games, built kites because we couldn't buy them, played war, but did it with what we called rubber guns. And I wonder how many people in this room even know what that means. Carved out of wood. And it's a good thing we made up those games because our parents had no time to sympathize with boredom. Mine didn't. If I came in and whined about not having anything to do, my mother would hand me a book or give me a firm push out the door with the admonition to go look at the clouds and see what I could imagine from their shape. Not what I thought I wanted, but certainly more sympathetic than my dad's usual response, which went something like this. "Nothing to do? Well, well." Have you ever tried sitting on your four fingers and leaning back on your thumb? A remark I came to dislike so much that I stopped saying anything about boredom, which was exactly what he intended. My parents were too early for the fine Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, but they would have loved it when he said, "Somebody's boring me. I think it's me." They thought, as I do now, that being bored is an insult to oneself. It announces that our range of interests is too small, that we have no imagination. There is always something worth our attention, even though it may not be shouting at us. Some of us, unfortunately, cannot hear a whisper. We've been deafened by the noise of too much, too soon, too easily. I'm not surprised that the disciples of Jesus remembered him as a man who could not stand boredom, whose great promise was, "I have come that you may have life and have it abundantly." Robust life, full, rich life. Not that pale, skinny thing that passes for life in some of us. I used to think it was strange when I was a boy in church that some of my elders who never seemed very excited about anything in this life, should talk so much about eternal life. And then when I grew up, I ran into a memorable comment in a book about how ironic it is that the average man who does not know what to do with his life wants another one which would last forever. It's interesting that we have raging moralists who are positive they know what God dislikes: sleazy bars, grimy little whorehouses, wickedly clever cynics, when the only thing he has ever said to spit out of his mouth in disgust is the person who is indifferent, lukewarm, bored. I get the clear feeling from the people who wrote the Bible that God is delighted by the joyously good, can even find some redeeming quality in those who go energetically wrong, but absolutely cannot stand the ones who mumble with a shrug, "Who cares?" The ones who stay on the sidelines for fear of being bumped or bruised. The New Testament is as insistent as my mother was. Get up. Get going. Take the plunge. If you try to shelter and save your life, Jesus said, you lose it. If you give it with passion to great ideas and causes, you find it. There is one word, one single word, that says more about the secret of a happy, fulfilled life than any other word I know. It's in the dictionary. It's not a made-up word. You find it among the E words. Can you guess it? Once upon a time, while you're guessing, when people were more superstitious than they are now, they used to talk about fairy godmothers who slipped around at night, looked into cradles, and cast all sorts of spells on little children. With the wave of a wand, they could endow a new baby with beauty, brains, courage, wealth, whatever they liked. But they never mentioned one of the most desirable gifts of all. Not a single fairy godmother I ever heard of leaned down close and whispered, "Lucky child, I bestow upon thee the gift of enthusiasm." That's the word. And it has a fascinating history. The ancient Greeks used it to describe certain people so excited and exciting that they appeared to be possessed. In theos, filled up by the indwelling presence of one of the gods. We've toned it down a little. Not a divine madness anymore, but still a potent word for people who react to things with eagerness, who feel the full potential of the moment, who care, who are alive. Nothing great, Emerson told us, was ever achieved without enthusiasm. It's a natural gift in childhood, where it only needs wise pruning so that it can focus its energy on bearing fruit, a thing any good parent knows. If you want to see enthusiasm encouraged and art set back, look at the plastered refrigerator door in any house with small children. Young or old, we love to bring some piece of work to a person we care about and have that person say, "Hey, this is interesting. We need to stick it on the fridge so everybody can see it." Talk that makes us expand like a tulip in the sun. Now, I said that young or old, we like to be greeted with enthusiasm, and I had a heartwarming proof of that last week. On my study desk at home sat two objects, only 2 feet apart in space, but separated in time by 30 years. One was a little plaster of Paris paperweight with green and yellow felt strips glued to the side for decoration. Some of you have seen this object. And a nail stuck through it for sticking any piece of paper I might wish to keep, brought home by a child in grade school in the full confidence that it would be gladly received and praised. And the other object was a stack of some of the dullest scholarly writing you could ever imagine. Brought home, dropped off just last week by the very same child. Now grown up, but still eager for my enthusiastic response to the work he does. This time he had finished a 16-hour comprehensive doctoral exam and he wanted me to rejoice with him. You can imagine how glad I am that he still wants a response, even though he would be the first to tell you what I said a moment ago, that what he had written was something no sensible person would read who didn't have to. Now, you may think I'm exaggerating, so let me read you an excerpt that makes even a sermon sound exciting. Examination question. How did Aristotle treat the thought element in rhetoric? 2 hours of response called for. I won't read all of that, but here is a sample. Answer. Aristotle believed that rhetoric was the counterpart of dialectic. In science, one sought to discover through demonstration. In dialectic, what we would call logic, syllogisms are often employed. In rhetoric, whose aim is persuasion, the enthymeme, you know about those, is central. An enthymeme is not a truncated syllogism, as has often been assumed, but a form of rhetorical syllogism. This came from OU, I say to one of our visitors this morning. An enthymeme has two species, the demonstrative and the refutative, both of which derive their materials from particular or universal topoi. Now, I have the rest of this at home if you'd like to borrow it. That's how people have to write sometimes to get a PhD. So I read as much of his exam as I could, worked up some enthusiasm, and said what I could truthfully say. This is impressive, and so are you. Here is a lifelong conviction. Anyone who can bring along out of childhood a capacity for excitement and enthusiasm is a very lucky person. Lucky to be alive, not just breathing, but alive. Lucky in spite of the fact that enthusiasm always makes one vulnerable to the ridicule of those who are indifferent, who put down your excited face with their face of weary boredom. Never mind. Better to seem silly at times than to walk around dead. And the good news is that life doesn't have to pass away with youth. We have people in this room still full of curiosity and excitement in their 80s. I've been needled a bit by some of my academic colleagues through the years for liking to watch the football and basketball games at the university. English professors are not supposed to like sports. The late president of Yale, an English professor himself, knew better. And there is more than one defense for that particular pastime. But the one I would give right now is that I love the enthusiasm generated by sports. I like to look around and see people excited, carried outside their apathy for an hour or so. And I like being caught up in their enthusiasm. I had some extra fun one night in Henry Levitt Arena watching the richest family in Wichita clap their hands and cheer and forget all about their grief with family and their troubles with business. Charles Kingsley had it right. We act as though comfort and luxury were the chief requirements of life, when all that we need to make us really happy is something to be enthusiastic about. I told you earlier that having too much can deaden enthusiasm. We get surfeited and forget how wonderful it is to have to wait and then to get something we have wanted for a long time. I remember a trivial example. When I was overseas in military service, I went for more than 2 years without a glass of cold milk and a bacon and tomato sandwich. I know that isn't exactly gourmet food, but the more impossible it was to have it, the more I thought it would be a banquet. I reached a point where the first thing I wanted to do when I got back home was go to a cafe, not for a steak or prime rib, but for real milk, not powdered milk, and a sandwich. And the day we landed in port and went down to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, that's what I did. I went into New Brunswick and ordered a quart of cold milk and 3 bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. If you had been there that day, you would have found a new meaning for the word enthusiasm. So if you get to feeling jaded or blasé, it might be possible to revive your sense of wonder by saying, suppose this were the only time. Suppose this sunset, this buttered toast, this sleeping child, this quiet conversation before the fire, I would never experience again. Maybe once in a while we ought to think that way and rediscover enthusiasm. And then share it with someone who is starving for a word of praise, a moment of trust. I talked with someone a few days ago who told her father how much she would like to finish the last half of college and become a nurse. If I had won the lottery last night, I would have sponsored her for the next 2 years in school without fail. Her father said, "Are you still talking about that silly pipe dream? Grow up. How would you like to have your fondest hope met by that kind of response over and over?" That happened to her. I sat there feeling a renewed appreciation for my father, who never went to college, but said when I wanted to go, out of no abundance, believe me, I'll do everything in the world I can to help you. Do you ever wonder how much of the best in your life you owe to people who believed in you, appreciated you, and could greet your hopes and plans with enthusiasm? Because finally, I suppose, enthusiasm is born of one kind or another of love. At a seminar some years ago, a psychiatrist asked a small group of people to consider the following situation. Gameplay. The end of the world has come. There is one day of life left. Whom would you choose to spend that day with? You can name only one person. Now, it's not so easy as you might think. Your wife, your husband, your children. But which one? It's a hard game to play, and in some ways perhaps nonsensical, but the ultimate point of it was that everyone in the room chose someone he or she loved. They didn't choose the wise or the famous. They chose someone they loved in a way that was very dear and very personal. There was no one who did not want to have love around at the end. Perhaps if we remembered that, we would have it with us more often in the middle.